From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Ontem o Brasil registrou 1,700...
Yesterday, Brazil recorded 1,726 deaths. The worst day of the pandemic in the entire history since March 2020. We will now face the worst 2 weeks of the pandemic since the first case of COVID-19 was confirmed in Brazil. This is a sad reality.
Brazil is facing a growing crisis as COVID-19 deaths soar to record highs from a highly infectious coronavirus variant, bringing Brazil's healthcare system to the verge of collapse. We'll get the latest. We'll also look at vaccine apartheid in Israel and the occupied territories. 40% of Israel's population has been fully vaccinated, but Israel has sent only 2,000 vaccine doses to the Palestinian Authority. This comes as the International Criminal Court opens a landmark probe into war crimes committed in the Palestinian territories, despite opposition from Israel and the United States.
This decision is so important because it shows that justice will be imposed on those who carry out crimes against the Palestinian people or any crime in the world.
We'll speak to the authors of the new book, Except for Palestine, The Limits of Progressive Politics, Mitchell Plitnick and Mark Lamont Hill.
This idea of being progressive except for Palestine is something that can be problematic. I think that if we worry about injustice, we have to be concerned with injustice across the board.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The House of Representatives has approved sweeping legislation protecting the right to vote. The For the People Act, also known as House Resolution 1, is the most comprehensive voting bill since the Voting Rights Act of 1965. It would curb partisan gerrymandering, provide automatic and election day registration, allow for 2 weeks of early voting and no excuse absentee voting, and it would provide publicly financed matching funds for congressional and presidential candidates. An amendment by Massachusetts Democratic Congressmember Ayanna Pressley to lower the voting age to 16 failed on the House floor. Another amendment to end the disenfranchisement of people who are incarcerated failed after 119 Democrats joined Republicans to defeat it. Missouri Democrat Cori Bush sponsored that amendment.
More than 5 million people are legally barred from participating in our elections as a result of criminal laws. That is 1 in 44 Americans, 500,000 Latinx Americans, 1.2 million women, and 1 in 6 Black folks. This cannot continue. Disenfranchising our own citizens, it is not justice.
House Resolution 1 does grant people with felony convictions the right to vote after they've completed the terms of their prison sentences. Also on Wednesday, the House passed the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act. The legislation would ban police chokeholds and eliminate qualified immunity for officers. It also seeks to ban racial and religious profiling at certain no-knock raids and would set up a national database to track police misconduct. Both bills now head to the Senate, where they'll need 60 votes to clear the threat of a Republican filibuster. The Capitol Police Department says it has uncovered a possible plot to attack Congress today, less than 2 months after a pro-Trump mob attacked the Capitol. The threat of violence prompted House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to move up votes on police reform and voting rights to Wednesday evening and to cancel Thursday's session. Senate leaders, however, are proceeding with business today. Members of the QAnon conspiracy theory believe that March 4th is the true inauguration day, when Donald Trump will be sworn in to a second term in the White House. On Wednesday, Texas Republican Congressmember Michael McCaul called on Trump to intervene.
I think President Trump has a responsibility to tell them to stand down. This threat is credible, and it's real.
On Wednesday, the head of the D.C. National Guard testified. Pentagon leaders put unusual restrictions on the deployment of troops to the Capitol complex ahead of the January 6 assault on Congress. General William Walker told a Senate panel it took over 3 hours to win approval from the Pentagon to send in National Guard soldiers after he received a frantic call from then-Capitol Police Chief Stephen Sund early on the afternoon of January 6 requesting help. That delay was even longer than previously reported. General Walker contrasted the response with the rapid and aggressive deployment of National Guard troops used to suppress Black Lives Matter protests in 2020. President Biden signed off on a plan to limit eligibility for a new round of stimulus checks as the Senate takes up its version of the $1.9 trillion coronavirus stimulus package. Biden's decision meets a key demand of conservative Democrats. The lowered eligibility would bring benefits to about 12 million fewer adults and 5 million fewer children. In Burma, at least 38 people were killed Wednesday as security forces continue to use live fire on protesters. It was the deadliest day since the February 1st military coup. Over 50 people have died since protests started, with many more wounded. A local group says some 1,500 people have been detained. The White House Wednesday did not rule out a military response to a rocket attack on a military base housing U.S. troops in Iraq. A U.S. civilian contractor died from a heart attack, but no other casualties were reported. This comes almost 1 week after Biden ordered a strike on Iranian-backed militant groups in eastern Syria without congressional approval. Meanwhile, Pope Francis is planning to travel to Baghdad Friday and is scheduled to meet with Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani on Saturday. Some view the visit as ill-advised. In addition to ongoing violence, a surge in coronavirus cases has prompted lockdowns in Iraq. The Vatican's own ambassador to Iraq recently tested positive for COVID-19. Brazil reported over 1,900 COVID deaths Wednesday, breaking its previous record death toll set just 1 day earlier. Brazil has topped 250,000 deaths, the second highest in the world after the U.S. A highly infectious coronavirus variant that crippled the health system in Manaus has spread elsewhere in Brazil and has been identified in at least 24 other countries, including the United States. It appears to be more likely to reinfect people who've already had COVID-19. Sao Paulo, Brazil's most populous state, is going into a 2-week lockdown. Sao Paulo Governor João Doria blamed President Jair Bolsonaro for the mounting crisis. He said, "This is your fault. It's because of your denialism," he said. Vaccines being delivered under the COVAX initiative have arrived in several more African nations this week, including Kenya, Nigeria, Senegal, Rwanda, and Sudan. So far, some 10 million doses have been delivered to 14 countries as part of COVAX, which helps less wealthy nations procure vaccines. The United States recorded over 66,000 new coronavirus cases and nearly 2,500 COVID-19 deaths Wednesday. At the White House, President Biden blasted the governors of Texas and Mississippi for ending statewide mask mandates and limits on indoor gatherings.
And the last thing we need is the Neanderthal thinking that in the meantime, everything's fine. Take off your mask. Forget it.
Texas Governor Greg Abbott said Tuesday his state would end all COVID-19 restrictions by March 10th. On Wednesday, Governor Abbott accused the Biden administration of recklessly allowing asylum seekers to cross the Mexican border into the U.S., blaming immigrants for exposing Texans and Americans to COVID-19. The immigrant rights group RAICES tweeted, quote, "It's official. Despite all the scientific evidence, Republicans now believe that borders work better than masks when it comes to stopping COVID-19. in Chicago. Over 100 activists are on hunger strike to protest the relocation of the General Iron metal shredding plant to the southeast side of Chicago, in an area with mostly black and brown residents and which already suffers from poor air quality due to industrial pollution. The scrapyard is being moved from its current location to make way for the controversial multi-billion dollar Lincoln Yards development. This is Oscar Sanchez, one of the hunger strikers, speaking to Democracy Now!
Our community is considered a sacrifice zone by the city, which continues policies of environmental racism. This is only the latest case of industry being pushed to black and brown communities in Chicago. We're calling on Mayor Lori Lightfoot to break the racist legacy of exploiting black and brown communities as dumping grounds for industry and allow our neighborhoods to breathe, to flourish.
A rally is planned in front of Mayor Lori Lightfoot's home later today to mark 1 month since the start of the hunger strike. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo apologized Wednesday in response to multiple accusations of sexual harassment and unwanted physical contact.
I never touched anyone inappropriately. I never knew at the time that I was making anyone feel uncomfortable.
Governor Cuomo has now been accused of harassment by two former aides and unwanted sexual advances and touching by a third woman, but has rejected calls for his resignation. New York's attorney general is overseeing an investigation into the allegations. Cuomo is also under fire for covering up thousands of COVID deaths in New York nursing homes. Lawyers for renowned political prisoner and journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal confirmed Wednesday he has tested positive for COVID-19. This is Professor Johanna Fernandez making the announcement at a rally calling for his release.
I just got a call from Bob Boyle, one of Mumia's, one of Mumia's attorneys. Mumia has COVID. She's in the infirmary. Their attorneys called our attorneys. He had gotten a rapid test. And they conducted another test, and it came out positive. So Mumia Abu-Jamal has COVID-19.
66-year-old Abu-Jamal suffers from several pre-existing conditions for which advocates say he has not received proper care. And country music legend Dolly Parton was vaccinated against COVID-19 Wednesday, less than a year after she made a million-dollar donation to Vanderbilt University that helped fund research into Moderna's mRNA shot. Parton shared video of her inoculation on social media with the caption, "Dolly gets a dose of her own medicine."
Well, hey, it's me. I'm finally going to get my vaccine. I'm so excited. I've been waiting a while. I'm old enough to get it, and I'm smart enough to get it. So I'm very happy that I'm going to get my Moderna shot today. And I wanted to tell everybody, I think you should get out there and do it too. I even changed one of my songs to fit the occasion. It goes, "Vaccine, vaccine, vaccine, vaccine. I'm begging of you, please don't hesitate. Vaccine, vaccine. Vaccine, vaccine, because once you're dead, then that's a bit too late."
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the quarantine report. When we come back, Brazil is facing a growing crisis as COVID-19 deaths soar to record highs from an infectious coronavirus variant bringing Brazil's healthcare system to the verge of collapse. Stay with us.
Thank you.
Amin's Tuesday Come Early. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman, joined by my co-host, Nermeen Sheikh. Hi, Nermeen.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world.
Well, World Health Organization officials warned Wednesday COVID-19 cases are increasing worldwide after falling for more than a month. We begin today's show in Brazil, which set a daily record for COVID-19 deaths Wednesday for the second day in a row. Brazil's death toll has now topped nearly 260,000, the world's second worst after the United States. Brazil's most populous state, Sao Paulo, announced new lockdown measures Wednesday. This is the governor, João Doria.
We will now face the worst 2 weeks of the pandemic since the first case of COVID-19 was confirmed in Brazil. This is a sad reality. For these sad reasons, we will comply with the recommendation of the Contingency Center, and the entire state of Sao Paulo will go to red phase starting at 0 o'clock next Saturday.
Brazil's far-right president, Jair Bolsonaro, opposes lockdowns and responded Wednesday that because of the stay-at-home policy, quote, people are going to die of hunger and depression, Bolsonaro said. But more states and cities are expected to follow Sao Paulo's direction as hospitals report being overwhelmed. International concern is also growing about the new highly infectious coronavirus variant P1, which overwhelmed the Amazonian city of Manaus, causing its hospitals to run out of oxygen. Less than 4% of Brazil's population has been vaccinated. And a health minister Bolsonaro fired last year has warned the failure to launch a rapid vaccination drive means, quote, the country is running the risk of becoming one big Manaus. This comes as the Brazilian government has just announced it reached an agreement to buy 100 million doses of Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine after negotiations over liability clauses. For more, we're joined by Dr. Marcia Castro, professor of demography and chair of the Department of Global Health and Population at the Harvard School of Public Health. She also chairs the Brazil Studies Program at Harvard Center for Latin American Studies. Welcome back to Democracy Now! We want to start, Professor, by asking about this 2 days of the highest death rate in this past year in Brazil, second only to the United States. Can you talk about why this is happening and what you feel needs to be done?
Sure. Thanks for having me. So Brazil has been second in number of deaths since June 7th, second to the U.S. So we had the first wave last year around April, May. And when things started to calm down, so it's never was never like a comfortable situation. But when the cases started going down and the deaths started going down, that was the time to try to do something that was not done in the beginning. But again, what we saw is this combination of inaction, but also wrongdoing. It's the president saying that masks gives you headaches, uncomfortable, and other crazy things. It's promoting the use of medicine that is not effective, chloroquine. So it's the combination of both, of not doing what you have to do, but doing wrong things that end up creating behaviors in the population. For example, I mean, we had Carnival and that there were all kinds of clandestine parties happening, people gathering without masks. So people following, so all the scientists following the data on COVID, we did expect the beginning of 2021 to be very difficult because things were relaxing. It was almost like we are done. We can go back to normal and no action. And last year in July, Pfizer offered vaccines to Brazil. Brazil denied buying vaccines three times. So by the time other countries are vaccinating, Brazil has only two options, is not trying to acquire more vaccines. So now that the house is on fire, that's when they decide to buy, but we don't know when those doses will come. So Brazil should be reeling vaccinating the largest number of people in the shortest time possible in order to contain what's happening. It's not doing this. So the scenario we see now, unfortunately, it's going to get worse before it gets better. And we're going to lose an unnecessary number of lives, which unfortunately, for the government, the loss of lives has been normalized. So that's a very frustrating, uncomfortable, and dramatic situation we're seeing in Brazil.
And Maria, could you talk about this new variant that's emerged? It emerged in December, the P1 variant. It emerged from the Amazon. What's known about this variant and what vaccines, the effect of vaccines might be against it?
Right. So the first time it was detected was in Manaus, and we have no evidence it was circulating in November. In December, it was found in about 51% of the samples that were tested. And in January, it was already 91%. So very fast takeover. And now other cities are starting to see the same. There is an analysis that was done and released last Friday showing that this particular variant is much more transmissible. So it's about 1.4 to 2.2 times more transmissible. So it really spreads very fast. The amount of the viral load of people infected with it, it's also very high. And we have documented cases of reinfection with this variant. We don't know if the vaccines we have in Brazil are fully effective against it. There is some analysis in vitro. We don't have analysis in vivo yet. So we have to wait. But what we know is that this P1 variant is now pretty much spread across Brazil. There are some cities that are testing the samples, and one of them in the interior of São Paulo, just this month in February, also 91% of the samples was P1. Rio de Janeiro is also making a lockdown starting this weekend. So what we know is that it's highly transmissible. It allows reinfections. So it's kind of a bad scenario because we have people that can be infected again. People that was never infected that can get infected with this one because of the high transmissibility. And we are not vaccinating people enough to try to create a barrier and contain the spread of this variant.
Well, you mentioned earlier that Brazil three times denied the possibility of purchasing vaccines, which is especially striking because Brazil has, of course, universal health care and a very good record of vaccinating people. So if you could say a little about the vaccines that Brazil is now administering, the CoronaVac vaccine from China, which is reportedly only just over 50% effective, as well as AstraZeneca, the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine.
Yeah, so what I would say is I wouldn't, you know, focus too much on those numbers, 50-something, 60-something. I mean, both of those vaccines were extremely effective in preventing serious cases, in preventing hospitalizations, and in preventing deaths. And that's what we need. So, you know, I usually say which one is the best vaccine. It's the one available. Put it in your arm and go ahead. Now, I think one thing we have to highlight is that Brazil is the only country in the world with more than 100 million people that has a universal health system and has a beautiful history of vaccination. In 2010, when we had the threat of H1N1, Brazil vaccinated 80 million people in 3 months. Brazil do campaigns in a weekend to vaccinate against polio, and it's able to vaccinate 10 million children in 2 days. So Brazil has the knowledge, has the network, has the community health agents, has the network of health units and the expertise to do mass vaccination. But what we need is, one, the vaccines, and two, we need campaigns. We need communication campaigns. We usually have, if we look historically, those mass campaigns on TV, you inform, you educate, and that contributes for people to comply to the interventions. We don't have that. So we have a lot of people in Brazil that took the first shot, and now they're not sure what they can do, if they can have gatherings, if they can party before they take the second shot, after they take the second shot. So we are also missing a campaign to make people aware. But the main point is all of those vaccines are good because they are phenomenal in preventing hospitalization and death. And that's what people should focus, not so much on the 50, 60, 70, 90. What we wanted to prevent are hospitalization, so the health system is not overloaded, and above all, to prevent death.
Professor Castro, speaking earlier this week in Rio, President Bolsonaro's son, Flavio, who is also a senator, condemned Brazil's lockdown strategy as a, quote, dictatorial measure.
Lockdown.
Lockdown is bad management. We all knew Carnival was coming. We all knew crowds were practically inevitable. And it's obvious that there will be an increase in cases. But here in the city and state of Rio, we have the capacity to provide treatment in intensive care units, showing that there has been planning and preparation. Because it is now much easier with the dictatorial measure to close a city, to close a state, to say that lockdown is doing something, to give their satisfaction to the people. Managing like a dictator is easy.
So that's the son of the COVID-denying, but a man who had COVID, the president of Brazil, Jair Bolsonaro. Of course, it sounds very similar to President Trump. He followed in his footsteps, as you said, used a lot of hydroxychloroquine in the United States. Hospitals are trying to give back hydroxychloroquine because President Trump pushed it baselessly, and many bought many doses. But if you can talk about what this denial means, and also Brazil being a site of testing. Johnson & Johnson was just approved, and it goes to that issue of, you know, exactly how effective it was. But it was approved later than the other two vaccines. So it means that it was tested against variants in places like Brazil and South Africa. And what it means to be a site of those tests, yet not to have the vaccines to treat their own people. And then what it means to get vaccines from places like, and people aren't outside of the United States so familiar with COVAX and Gavi and how important they are in the developing world.
That's a great question. I mean, the Janssen vaccine would be the ideal vaccine in Brazil right now. It's one shot. You don't need the special freezers. You can go to the Amazon forest, to the semi-arid, to any corner of the country and deploy the vaccine. One shot, fast, done, right? We didn't buy it. It was tested in Brazil, and we didn't buy it. So how can we understand this discourse from, you know, the president and his sons? I wish I knew. I don't even know if a psychologist can understand. But the thing is, we can have our opinions, but they make their opinions the facts. And that's misleading. That's misinformation, right? So the hospitals in Rio are overloaded. There are barely any ICU beds left, right? So the lockdown is needed, because nothing was done before. Lockdown is the last resort, right? If we do something right, if we plan ahead, we don't have to do lockdowns, right? But we never did anything. So I think the bad management is all the lack of action. The bad management is promoting drugs that are not effective. So there's a long list of what bad management is. Certainly, bad management is not trying to do the right thing to save lives. But again, this government normalized the loss of lives, and it's not just the lives lost, it's all the dreams that were interrupted, the families that was disrupted. None of that seems to touch or, you know, make the government make the right decision. So these are not the facts. These are just a way of trying to change the public opinion, people that still believe that this is a good leader. So it's misinformation being done over and over and over again.
When I referred to the two vaccines, I meant the two that were being used in the United States, Pfizer and Moderna. And Stat has an interesting article saying Pfizer plays hardball in COVID-19 vaccine negotiations, insisting some governments cover the potential costs of civil cases that result from its own acts of negligence, fraud, or malice. Pfizer being accused of bullying Latin American governments during negotiations to acquire the vaccine, and the company asking some countries to put up sovereign assets such as embassy buildings and military bases as a guarantee against the cost of any future legal cases. This was according to an investigation by the UK-based Bureau of Investigative Journalism. Can you talk about that negotiation that went on in Brazil? Ultimately, Brazil apparently going to buy 100 million doses. But what this means, and are you following this accusation of Pfizer bullying Latin American countries?
So the announcement of the acquisition of the doses was just made yesterday. It's actually 100 million from Pfizer, and I believe 38 from Janssen. So, but there is no timeline, no expectation. All that there was said is hopefully those doses will come in the second semester. So I don't know when. I am not aware of the bullying. I don't know what kind of negotiation was made with Brazil or if the government had to give any guarantees. I find this a little bit disturbing, actually, because especially in a moment of a public health emergency, what we should see is the opposite. It's like, for example, getting two competitors like Merck and Johnson & Johnson to pair to produce more doses. Collaboration is what we should see, not bullying. So I'm gonna investigate that. I wasn't aware about that. So thank you for bringing that up.
And very quickly before we conclude, Maria, you have emphasized the importance of genomic sequencing. Could you explain what that is and why you think it's necessary fighting the pandemic?
Yeah. So. Ideally, what we should have is a network that brings countries together, actually. And who should oversee this, if it's going to be WHO or another entity, I don't know. But it has to be a collaborative network that actually there are sentinel surveillance of samples, and we can try to identify new pathogens when they come. Now, what we see now with COVID, not a single country did more genomic sequencing than the UK. So the advantage of this, you can identify when new pathogens are circulating, and in the case of an emergency, you can identify when a new variant has emerged. So in Brazil, we have something. It's a network that was set up for influenza, and Brazil is one of the centers that contribute genetic information, so WHO knows what should be the composition of the flu vaccine each year. But it's very small. It's not representative of the country. It's not designed to identify new things that are circulating. Right now, one of the things the government could have done is to bring together university labs that have the potential to do genomic sequencing, private laboratories that are doing a lot of COVID tests, bring everybody together in an effort to sequence those samples that people are having access to try to identify those variants. We didn't have that. We had no support, no incentive from the federal government to really strengthen this network so we could do real genomic sequencing and then anticipate the introduction of those variants and try to contain people that, you know, the first cases that appear, so we prevent that from spreading. If you have no surveillance like this, the moment you know things are there, it's already too late. And that's the situation we see in Brazil now. The house is already on fire. And what we have to do is to save people that are inside those houses, but the house is gonna come down.
Professor Marcia Castro, we want to thank you so much for being with us. And by the way, condolences on the death of your dad.
Thank you.
Professor Castro teaches demography and is chair of the Department of Global Health and Population at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health, also co-chairs the Brazil Studies Program at Harvard Center for Latin American Studies. As we continue our coverage of the pandemic, this is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh as we turn to what some are calling vaccine apartheid in Israel and the occupied territory. Israel's had the fastest vaccination rollout in the entire world. 40% of Israelis have already been fully vaccinated. More than 8 million shots have been administered. Israel's also vaccinated Jewish residents living in illegal settlements in the occupied West Bank. But Palestinians have yet to even begin a public vaccination rollout. By one count, just 34,000 vaccine doses have been delivered to the occupied territories, where some 4.5 million Palestinians live. Most of the vaccines came from the United Arab Emirates and Russia. The New York Times reports Israel has sent just 2,000 doses to the Palestinian Authority, with a promise for 3,000 more. Israel's also been accused of delaying vaccine shipments into Gaza. On Sunday, Israel announced it would also start vaccinating some Palestinians who work inside Israel and inside the illegal settlements. This comes as Israel has begun rolling out a vaccine passport system where people would need to show proof of vaccination to access certain facilities in Israel. We're joined now by the co-authors of the new book, Except for Palestine, The Limits of Progressive Politics. Mark Lamont Hill is a professor of media studies and urban education at Temple University in Philadelphia. Mitchell Plitnik is the president of Rethinking Foreign Policy. Plitnik is also the former director of the U.S. Office of B'Tselem and co-director of Jewish Voice for Peace. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Mark Lamont Hill, if you can talk about what is happening now in the occupied territories when it comes to access to the vaccine.
What we're seeing right now is a gross injustice. Right now, Israel has one of the most impressive rollouts of vaccines. When you look at the population over 50, the numbers are extraordinary. When you look at the overall population of Israeli citizens who have gotten the vaccine, the numbers are the best in the world. But that number only is impressive if you don't count those Palestinians living in the West Bank, those living in Gaza. When you add those numbers in, what we see is a basic denial of Palestinians of the right to or access to the vaccine. And what the Israeli government has argued is that because of the Oslo Accords of 1993, that Palestinians are responsible for their own self-care and their own access to the vaccine. That is untrue for two reasons. One is that the Fourth Geneva Convention trumps that. Despite what the Israeli government has argued, they have a responsibility to make sure in an occupied territory that their health is protected, particularly from a pandemic. But also, the Oslo Accords don't suggest that. The Oslo Accords still would suggest that the Israeli government has a responsibility to coordinate, and particularly under the circumstance of a pandemic, control of the pandemic vis-a-vis a vaccine. And so in both cases, in either case, the Palestinian people are denied what international law suggests and what, quite frankly, I think just good medical judgment would suggest, which is that everyone in the region should get access to a vaccine.
And Mitchell Plitnik, your response to that, the argument in particular that Israel has put forward that Mark just talked about, that the Oslo Accords effectively supersede the Fourth Geneva Convention.
Yeah, so I have an article all about that very point on Medium that people can look up. But the summary of it is that the Oslo Accords don't say that. The Oslo Accord actually lays out a very specific schedule of vaccines that the Palestinian Authority is assuming responsibility for. And they're the routine vaccines that most of us get when we're children. In fact, it's so specific that not only do they list the vaccines, they even list when the Palestinian Authority – is required to administer them. So it's a very clear list. And another clause in that same area says that when unusual epidemics like COVID-19 come up, that Israel and the Palestinian Authority commit to work together to combat them as one. So I think it's very clear that Oslo, between that and as Mark mentioned, the fact that the Fourth Geneva Convention still holds and the occupying power is ultimately responsible no matter what, this argument that Israel is making is just not, it's just false. It's just a lie.
And then if you could talk about what one of the Israeli officials just recently said when it comes to comparing Palestinians getting vaccines. I believe he said something along the lines of that would be like Palestinians being responsible for vaccinating dolphins in the Mediterranean.
Well, doesn't that just show, the attitude here? When people talk about this being a sort of medical apartheid, I think that just shows, it shows the attitude, that statement reflects a complete, it's sort of directly saying that Palestinians are not humans, that they are not as important as Israelis. In other words, the comparison is not saying that, Palestinians should be responsible for vaccinating people in Chad, right? It's not comparing to other people. It's comparing to non-humans. And I think that's what that statement reflects. And it shows the complete indifference to Palestinian health, which, of course, is self-defeating, because if Palestinians are not immunized against COVID, ultimately Israelis are not safe either. So the dehumanization goes to such an extent that they're even continuing to put Israelis at risk, despite the undoubtedly successful effort to roll out the vaccines within Israel.
To be exact, it was the Israeli health minister likening his obligation to vaccinate Palestinians to Palestinians' responsibility to care for dolphins in the Mediterranean. Mitchell Plitnik and Mark Lamont Hill, we're going to go to break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about your book, Except for Palestine, The Limits of Progressive Politics. We will also link to Mitchell's piece in Medium, Israel is responsible for vaccinating Palestinians under occupation. Even the Oslo Accords say so. Stay with us. Alicia Keys. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. The International Criminal Court has officially opened a probe into Israeli war crimes in the Palestinian territories, as well as crimes committed by Palestinian militant groups. Israel and the United States blasted the decision. Israel's not a member of the ICC, but the Palestinians joined the court in 2015. Israel's argued the court has no jurisdiction over the occupied territories because Palestine is not an independent state. On Wednesday, Fasil Abu Youssef of the Palestinian Liberation Organization welcomed the ICC decision.
This decision is so important because it shows that justice will be imposed on those who carry out crimes against the Palestinian people, or any crime in the world. The Israeli occupation thought that they were exempt from the crimes that they committed, and that they won't be questioned for these crimes. Today, this decision will cut off the ways for occupation to continue committing these crimes. I think the occupation will think deeply about how to defend itself in front of the court.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu responded by claiming the ICC decision is anti-Semitic.
The decision of the International Court to open an investigation against Israel today for war crimes is absurd. It's undiluted anti-Semitism and the height of hypocrisy. This court that was established to prevent the repetition of the Nazi horrific crimes committed against the Jewish people is now turning its guns against the one and only state of the Jewish people. It's targeting Israel, the only democracy in the Middle East. But of course, it turns a blind eye to Iran, Syria, and the other dictatorships that are committing real war crimes.
The Biden administration also criticized the ICC. Secretary of State Tony Blinken said, quote, "The United States firmly opposes and is deeply disappointed by this decision. The ICC has no jurisdiction over this matter. We'll continue to uphold our strong commitment to Israel and its security, including by opposing actions that seek to target Israel unfairly," Blinken said. Still with us, the co-authors of the new book, Except for Palestine, The Limits of Progressive Politics, Mark Lamont Hill, Temple University Professor of Media Studies and Urban Education, and Mitchell Plitnick, president of Rethinking Foreign Policy, also the former director of the U.S. Office of B'Tselem and former co-director of Jewish Voice for Peace. Mark Lamont Hill, let's begin with your response to the ICC decision to investigate Israel for war crimes.
I am always skeptical of the ability to adjudicate these matters in international criminal courts, not because I don't believe in them, but because I'm often skeptical that they'll actually produce a fair and just outcome. But this is a moment of promise. This is a moment of possibility. The fact that the ICC last month acknowledged that it had jurisdiction and this month says that it's going to actually open up an investigation, I think, is extraordinary. It's important, though, to respond to what Prime Minister Netanyahu said. First, this is not a probe exclusively targeted toward Israel. Obviously, Hamas will also be investigated, and ostensibly the PA could be, although this is largely about Operation Protective Edge, and so won't focus on them, meaning that any war crimes in the territories and in the area could be investigated. Second, the idea that the ICC is somehow targeting Israel, to me, is a bit curious when, quite frankly, the African countries are the only people who seem to get any kind of rebuke or censure or criticism from the international courts, whether it's Muammar Gaddafi, whether we look at the LRA in Uganda. I mean, we could look at Sudan. I mean, the critiques of the actions of the ICC are largely directed toward African nations, not the West, not Europe, and not Israel. And it would be anti-Semitic. It would absolutely be anti-Semitic to only investigate Israel, to only focus on Israel. But the ICC is not attempting to do that. And then finally, the argument somehow that Palestine is not a state and therefore is not able to appeal to the ICC simply is contradicted by international law. It's contradicted by the UN's decision a few years ago. They absolutely have the jurisdiction. And this is an opportunity for not just Israel, but for the United States to actually reset relations with the ICC and actually move toward an investigation that could produce justice. And the fact that the Biden administration has resisted that and that this is one of those areas where Biden has not reversed course from Trump. Right. He reverses from Trump on Muslim bans, on the Paris Accords, on all these issues. But on the ICC, he's making a different choice. And that different choice is very disappointing.
And Mitchell, your response to the ICC decision to investigate both Palestinians and Israelis for war crimes. And if you could respond, I mean, Mark said about Netanyahu saying that Israel is being singled out and that it's principally African nations that have been investigated by the ICC. But what about war crimes being committed elsewhere from Syria to Yemen? Those have not been referred to the ICC. Could you respond to that?
So, yeah, I mean, first of all, I share with Mark skepticism about the outcome of the ICC investigation. First of all, the current prosecutor, Fatou Bensouda, will be stepping down in June, and her replacement, Kamil Khan, is someone we don't know what he thinks specifically about this issue, but we do know that both the United States and Israel are optimistic about his appointment. So that kind of makes me nervous about where this is going to go. On top of that, you know, Hamas, because of the nature of the two sides and the weaponry that Israel has versus the weaponry Hamas has, Hamas uses weaponry that is by definition indiscriminate. It cannot distinguish between its targets. It's very difficult to aim properly. So it's going to be it does not meet the standards of international law. Almost by definition, Hamas will be found guilty of war crimes, whereas with Israel, it's more difficult, and there are more questions of international law involved. So I'm skeptical about a positive outcome here, as Mark is, which is not to say that war crimes were not committed. I think that's clear. The question is not, you know, what we know happened, but what we can prove happened. And that's always a problem because of the way international law is constructed. So starting with that, as far as what Netanyahu said, first, you know, let me say, as a Jewish person, that using anti-Semitism and even worse, using the Holocaust to shield Israel from it being investigated for potential war crimes is remarkably contemptible and deeply offensive to me personally, and I think to many Jews around the world. The issue is very simple. If you committed war crimes, you should be investigated. If you didn't commit war crimes, what are you worried about? So I think there is that point. And there's also, look, you know, the fact is that a major complaint against the ICC has been that it's almost solely focused on Africa, with Yugoslavia having been the only real exception here up until now. And we'll see again where this goes. But it's a fair criticism to say that that the ICC has not applied standards of justice globally. Part of that is because we see the kind of backlash that it faces when, for example, it goes up against the United States and tries to investigate U.S. war crimes in Afghanistan. It is a lot of this backlash is tied to that as well. It's not just defense of Israel. It's also the U.S. looking at its own war crimes and not wanting those to be investigated by an international body. So all of that is kind of coming together here.
And I'd like to turn now, Mark, to the book that the two of you have just brought up called Except for Palestine, The Limits of Progressive Politics. Mark, can you lay out the argument there?
You know, Mitchell and I are very excited to write this book, particularly at this moment. We didn't know who would be president. We didn't know that there'd be an ICC investigation. But all the issues that are coming up right now really speak to the various ways that Palestinians have been made the exception to many of our progressive values and politics and actions. If you think about, in activist circles, I'll start there. In activist circles, you know, we have this person we call the PEP, right? The person who's progressive except for Palestine. This is the person that's outraged at Trump for his actions at the border, who's disgusted by, you know, children in cages, who can't stand to think about the erosion of civil liberties. But when it comes to Palestine, somehow they don't engage those same ideas in the same way. And so in our book, what we attempt to do is lay out the kind of policy groundwork. We lay out the frontier on which these battles are fought. We want people to understand not just the contradictions of the so-called left, but also to understand how those contradictions emerge. So whether it's questions about the right to exist, whether it's questions about BDS, the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement, or whether it's the attempt to make Trump the exception rather than part of a more aggressive articulation of the American rule, we are attempting to show that the American left, those who identify as progressive, radical, liberal, what have you, have not held up the bargain in terms of matching their own ideals and values on this question of Israel and Palestine. And that's something that we want to raise. I'll give one quick example. Donald Trump, who we've made the boogeyman, and for good reason, moved the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, and that was seen as outrageous. Of course, him acknowledging Jerusalem as the undivided capital of Israel goes against international law. It goes against the idea that will allow Jerusalem to be a final status issue. But Donald Trump didn't create that rule. Donald Trump actually was acting on decades of American policy. The Jerusalem Embassy Act was actually signed by Congress in 1995. Under the times of Clinton. And every U.S. president has simply signed a waiver not to move the embassy, but no one has fought to actually get rid of the legislation. So this is bipartisan American policy. Again, Trump is he was American policy on steroids, but he was part of a bipartisan movement to neglect the values, the needs, the self-determination of the Palestinian people. And in our book, we try to lay that out in what we think is a compelling way.
And Mitchell, if you can talk more about the weaponization of anti-Semitism, silencing those who might otherwise be critics.
Yeah, I mean, that is reaching a fever pitch right now. And I think it's actually reflective of where Israel itself has gone. I think Israel has abandoned a lot of the veneer of idealism that it once had, and any legitimate idealism it once held for itself, and is now simply, we hear the arguments in Washington about why we support this or that Israeli policy, and it's all about an unbreakable bond and an undying friendship. It's not about geostrategic thinking anymore. It's not about Israel is actually right and anymore. It is simply about the idea that this is our ally. We're going to stand by her. And I think this is part of it. So when you're trying to actually engage in the debate, you don't want to debate the issues. You want to simply say anyone who criticizes Israel is anti-Semitic. And, Jews are certainly, as I know your audience is very well aware, we are certainly not immune from that accusation. I'm certainly not. I get called anti-Semitic all the time. So we're seeing a lot of arenas right now with Facebook trying to collapse the phrase Zionism as a proxy so that you cannot criticize Zionism or Zionist thinking or the Zionist movement without being called anti-Semitic. I mean, that's part of that battle. Of course, the IHRA, International Holocaust Remembrance Association definition brings in the same problematic language. And the idea is to shut down all criticism of Israel. And the reason is because Israel can no longer defend itself against that criticism. Supporters of Israel can no longer argue that there's any legitimacy to dispossessing an entire people and holding them without rights for decades, for generations. There's no argument that's going to stand up to that. So instead, you simply call the person who's making the criticism anti-Semitic.
Before we go, I wanted to end Mark Lamont Hill by asking you about what's happening with Mumia Abu-Jamal, who is in prison in Pennsylvania. You co-authored a book with him years ago titled The Classroom in the Cell, Conversations on Black Life in America. Mumia's lawyers confirmed Wednesday he's tested positive for COVID-19, also has congestive heart disease. Mumia also suffers from pre-existing conditions of liver disease, which advocates say is directly related to the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections' failure to treat his hepatitis C in a timely fashion. His doctor, Dr. Ricardo Alvarez, says the only appropriate treatment is freedom. What do you think needs to happen now? And what was your response to hearing about his COVID-19 diagnosis?
I spoke to Mumia a week ago, right before he went into the hospital. He had labored breathing. He was clearly very ill. I didn't quite know what was going on, but I knew that he was very ill, and it was no surprise to hear that he was rushed to the hospital. They pumped almost 10 pounds of fluid of some sort out of his body. He's been made sick by this prison system, whether it's not treating his hep C, as you mentioned, or the fact that he got COVID. And there are no visitors coming in. There are no guests coming in. The only people who are giving and transmitting COVID through this prison are prison guards who come in. They don't wear masks, not just as a matter of policy, but as a matter of some weird right-wing principle. And as a result, people are dying. And so the only resolution, the only possible solution, the only fair solution is to let Mumia out of prison, not just Mumia, but all political prisoners, all people over 50, not just all political prisoners, quite frankly, although people like Russell Maroon Schultz, who's 77 years old and who survived COVID but is suffering from cancer, should be sent home. All of our elders should be sent home. This is an opportunity to exercise COVID compassion. We've seen over the last 6 months.
Mark, we have five seconds.
Let them go. Free them all.
Well, Mark Lamont Hill, I'm also glad to be talking to you with you being over COVID right now. Mark Lamont Hill and Mitchell Plitnik are co-authors of the book Except for Palestine, The Limits of Progressive Politics. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Libby Rainey, Maria Tarasena, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Trina Nadura. Special thanks to Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Stay safe.